It's always a pleasure to be in Ostend. Before I start, I would like to say a few words on the presentation by Felicity. I think such an overview, it's difficult for me at this moment to give, and I was really, really pleased with all these frames that you give. And actually, I will do a little bit more plumbing for people that want to go into deeper studies on the topics that you brought so nicely here in the audience. So let's go ahead. And why fishing in an underwater world? Well, this is, of course, meaning to say that what happens below the sea, in the seas or below the water level, is less clear to human beings. We are very anthropomorphic, anthropocentric in everything we do. So, in fact, we should more go diving. I did this once, and I'm claustrophobic, so I'm not doing it again. But it is, if you want to know more what you can see underwater, Dos Winkel is here, one of the best photographers for fish underwater, and have a chat with him later on. Let's see where we can go. So I will give you a few examples of where I'm intrigued by fish. These are slides from lectures that I normally give in Nijmegen in the curricular biology courses. And this is a slide which you all should understand to better understand fish, and that is about whole genome duplications. We, human beings and fish, share an ancestor, and that's a tunicate-like animal, so a chordate, an animal which makes a corda and then on top develops a neural tube and so on and so on. In that shared ancestor, whole genome duplications occurred. And in fact, there is at least two whole genome duplications early, and then at the branch where the fish will appear, evolutionarily spoken, there's a third one, and in some recent species, like common carp, for instance, 16 million years ago, and notice that what I call recent, 16 million years ago, there's a fourth whole genome duplication. What is the consequence of that? It means that the library for protein is extended. And of course, it will also be contracted and so on and so on. But there's lots of things going on, DNA chemistry, which eventually determines the animals as you see them. For instance, if you look at an extant species like a zebrafish, then it is an apparently diploid animal. But if you know this, then you also know that the animal may actually have a 16-fold DNA genome, but that also has given these animals the space, the room, to show adaptations to essentially every niche that you can imagine in the world. You will find fish everywhere, even in dry environments and so on and so on. I'm not going to talk about that, but there is a huge capacity for adaptability in fish. To give you an impression, and this is just a side slide, this is the situation on Earth in the Devonian, that is the era of the rise of fishes. And what you can see, and I'm not going into detail, there was a major landmass and a Pantalassian sea. And if you compare, if you're going to study the composition of that sea and present-day compositions of seas, you will see it's completely different, ionically and so on and so on. And it indicates, because the fish were on the rise in the Devonian already, that means there must be an enormous adaptability, because the fish has a semi-permeable skin, and it's semi-permeable, so there's osmosis and ionic movements and so on and so on. So give it a thought. And then there were major disasters on Earth, at least five mass extinctions. And again, if you look at the Devonian somewhere here, then you can see that at the early start of the rise of the fishes, the radiation of the fishes, they had to deal with a major impact on Earth. And read the numbers in here, you will see that almost all life on Earth disappeared a few times and had to restart. And give it a thought, what does it mean? And why not in fishes? Or how come that fishes survived all these mass extinctions? Well, it is for sure partly because of their huge genome adaptability. I'll give you an example of the fishes, and here you then have to look at this area, so there's the phylogenetic tree of fishes, and this is just a small number that you see here. But what you also see here, this is at Devonian times, where all of a sudden many, many, many species of fish occurred on Earth. And what you call a fish, and I apologize if I say something rude to you, but what you call, and now I mean the layman public, if you go to the market or whatever, if you say fish, people say, well, they think mainly of this, the plate with fish, and they do not know that there are at the moment at least 35,000 species of fish. So the abundance of fish species is phenomenal, and keep it in mind, because it means the genome of each species is different, and that means that everything is different between fish. You cannot simply compare one fish to another. Here is an example, again, a phylogenetic approach. To give you one example, here is the zebrafish on the right, and here is the medaka somewhere. Yeah, here's Oritzias. Those are two model fish used very often nowadays, but have a look at the timeline of their evolution. It means that the zebrafish is much older than a medaka. Why are zebrafish and medaka used? Well, they're model fish, they're easy to handle, and so on and so on. The genome is quite well known, but do realize yourself that the genome of a medaka underwent far less evolutionary pressure than that of a zebrafish. And keep it in mind. And as an example of the phenomenal radiation capacity of fish, is just one. So I put a reminder line on top. It is what you call a fish maybe is different as a mouse and a moose. Only one letter difference, completely different animals, of course. So as an example of the extreme adaptability, you see here the genetic richness of swordtails, which have led to a phenomenal radiation of this fish. And this is just to give you an impression of what is possible in fish. We've seen the disasters in Africa with the temporary disappearance of the cichlids. And here you see an example of natural radiation of swordtails in the around the Gulf of Mexico. So a few more two more examples of extreme adaptations. First, exploring the deep. It was just mentioned that coffee, our planet is more water than anything else, and we know very, very little about the deep. But if you go into the deep, you find these fish that live at 5-6 kilometers deep, at pressures 500-600 atmospheres, unimaginable for me at least. You've seen me at the surface. I'd like to stay to one atmosphere. But these fish have proteins developed with a richness in proline-proline tandems that make their proteins more stiff. Their membranes have been adapted to another fluidity such that they can still live. Your enzymes and your membranes will not work at the pressures that these fish encounter. Fish are everywhere, as I said. You see one swimming, and they also have lights. They have big mouth, just open the gate, put a light here, come here, my prey, and this is how it... I just show it as a wonderful example of adaptation. Oh, yeah. I'm going to stand here, sorry about that. It's always when I get enthusiastic, I'm moving too much. The deep, the dry. Not many people know that I could address you as Sarcopterygian. You're one of the Sarcopterygians. The fish that derived from this shared ancestor. There were several lines, I will show you in a sec. But you are part of the Sarcopterygian group of animals on Earth. The other line is the Actinopterygians. Those are the ray-finned fishes. And we are member of the group that we share with the coelacanths and the lungfishes. So we need legs to leave the water and get to the land. Mind you, in evolution, one of the major steps, of course, to get out of the water onto the land. And if you then look at the fins and the limbs of animals, in the vertebrate animals, you will see that the Bauplan, we use German for this kind of thing, the Bauplan for our legs, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, legs or arms is the same, is already present in fish. So it is a bit of physiology and anatomy that you find in fish, and that later will be used for walking on land, and that's what we call an acceptation. Read Stephen Jay Gould if you want to know more about this phenomenon. What you also see is the enormous radiation of the fish, the actinopterygian fish. So we are linked to this one, the lobe-finned group, but the actinopterygia are the 35,000 species that we're dealing with nowadays. Huge. Here, just to show you a funny slide, that these coelacanths once were quite abundant. There's a whole bunch of them. We study them because they can tell us things about our brains, for instance, and that is in this part of the slide. If you go from water to land, there should be, according to Darwinian evolution, a missing link. And Tiktaalik is this famous link at the moment, an animal that combines fishy properties like dermal scales and a fish tail, but also these lobe fins to walk on, and the head, which is typical for an amphibian species, like this is like a frog, or some people say it's like a crocodile, whatever. This is a typical example of gradualism as predicted by Darwin, and it's still there. Tiktaalik is from the Inuit, because these fossils were found in Inuit country, and Inuit called the eel pout, this fish, which also walks on the bottom. They took the eel pout as a name giver for this fossil. If you go from water to land, you have to change your vision for quality. So that's what you see here, the Tiktaalik with the fish tail and the eyes on top. It can spot prey on top, on the tree branches over the water. And if you look carefully at evolutionary lines, you will see that there is a certain trend, a tendency, and not in details everywhere, but it is very fun to see that the development of terrestrial life forms also gave rise to our big brains eventually. There's a very clear correlation between the qualities and the capacities that you need as a vertebrate for hearing and vision on land and the development of the brains. And that's why this Tiktaalik and studies of this kind of animals is so very, very much interesting. There's more to say. I leave this slide for you to study when you're at home. It's about the ecomorphology of fish, and you will see that fish, depending on the environment, adapt with special qualities in vision or hearing or whatever, and this has reflections on the brain qualities and the brain sizes. And mind you, it is very important for you as a biologist to be critical on what size, for instance, means. A bigger brain does not always mean that you're more clever. An elephant is probably more clever than the average human being, and indeed has a much bigger brain than we have, and whales also. But there's, of course, lots of other considerations in size. One example, the archer fish, which is a remarkable animal in that it can hunt for prey by jumping out of the water, like here, but it can also spout water to catch a prey which is above the water on a leaf, for instance. This is unbelievable. If you think of the coordination, vision, knowing where to direct with two different braking indexes for the media and so on, what has to go on in the brain of these fish. If you then look into the brain of these fish, you will see a remarkably large optical tectum. Just as an example for you to see what is going on evolutionarily wise. And this is just one species out of 35,000. So keep in mind that you may find all kinds of adaptations in fish. One thing that I want to mention, and there was already in one of the former presentations a remark on temperature. Well, what I find important for people working on fish to know is they almost all are ectotherms. Of course, there are trials in fish biology to become regulated with relation to temperature, body temperature. But in general, they are ectotherms, and they use far less energy for their daily maintenance. We, birds and human beings and mammals, we put the central heating on, and that costs a lot of energy. Not so in fish. So even when we warm up, cool down or warm up, we have to spend energy on staying within the temperature neutral zone. Not so in fish, and you see the enormous difference in energy that it takes for a fish to have a happy life when it comes to temperature. But it is the external temperature that determines the biochemistry of the fish, and the physiology, of course. So what makes fish so different from higher vertebrates? Many species. Be careful with extrapolations. They live mostly in aqueous environment. Breathe via gills. I will show a little bit on that in a minute. A very delicate epithelium. And not the adrenergic and steroid axis, universal systems in vertebrates invented by fishes, but their gills are vulnerable targets for stress hormones. I will show you a little bit on that. And stress in fish disturbs the hydromineral balance. And that is a key crucial difference with terrestrial animals. So keep that in mind. If you stress a fish, you disturb its hydromineral balance. So it is my specialty, my task at the university to teach on stress physiology. That's what I did for more than 40 years almost. And you can find our recent views on the stress system, the stress axis, the endocrine stress axis in fish. And without going into detail, because it takes a month of teaching, you can see that it's complicated. And why is this so interesting to show? It is even more complicated than in a human being. So it means the fish has this radiational qualities, it has the capacity to adapt, and all the tools are there. Here you see some slides of the pituitary axis, and if you want to know more, I can tell you during coffee. Gills are a target, and this is an interesting thing for everybody, I would say. The gills are multifunctional epithelium, gas exchange and ion transport, pavement cells and chloride cells. And what's going on? Depending on whether a fish lives in fresh or seawater, or when it is a urohaline species, it will live in both fresh or seawater. It depends on cortisol and growth hormone in seawater, or cortisol and prolactin in freshwater, to make the chloride cells, the ionic machines in the gills, either freshwater or seawater type. And you could seriously question then, is cortisol in this case a stress hormone? No, there is basal activity of stress, what we call stress hormones, required for all kinds of permissive actions of cortisol to allow playing with the type 1 alpha helical cytokines like growth hormone and prolactin. So please keep that in mind. Another thing that we studied quite extensively is the allostatic view on stress, which is, this is a picture taken from a typical website for human views on stress, where you see that the stress level increases to the right and the performance of the organism is in a bell-shaped situation presented here. That is, by the way, a far more interesting approach and a better approach than a homeostatic control, because this is an allostasis relationship. Allostasis meaning constancy through change. That means that the control of the performance is reset, the set points for control are reset. I will show you another slide in a minute. And there are situations when there's too little stress, then the performance upon the next challenge, stress challenge, will be poor. When there's too much, it will also be poor. But there is a whole area of stress where things are not too bad at all. In fact, that's where organisms learn. And you have to learn, of course, to deal with future new phenomena. We've discussed this in detail for fish, and we've shown, we spent more than 10 years on study showing that the relationship between stress level and performance of the fish is not a linear negative correlation, but a bell-shaped one like this. And if you are going to stress the fish, you induce a sort of an allostatic state, it's called, and depending on the degree of stress, you will have more or less space, say, qualities to deal with that stressor. What is maybe easier to understand is this slide that we published in a book on stress. If you look at the environmental challenge and the fish quality, or what does it say, fitness of the fish, you have this green corner where everything is okay, and the right top corner where everything is bad. And try for yourself to find out, what are the conditions of my fish? Where do I start my experiment? Do I start here or do I start here? And see the consequences of that. And the consequences that should be realized is that an environmental challenge has at least four qualities. That is intensity and duration, predictability, nicely shown already, and controllability. Can I escape? predictability. Do I know what is coming? But that holds for one stressor. But a fish in any condition that you test will have many stressors. Light conditions, water quality conditions, water temperature, and so on and so on. So it's the sum of stressors, each with these four components that you have to consider. And that is what we call allostasis. And allostasis implicitly means that higher brain functions are involved. In our case, it means that there is awareness in fish. And fish are therefore sentient beings. And it is an indirect approach, but from a basic physiological approach that we can say so, that there must be awareness. The fish knows what's going on in its environment and adjusts set points for a regulation of stress, because there's many, many differences. You've seen it already in one of the former slides. In depth, the cortisol levels are differing depending on the conditions where you take the fish from. Sometimes you can see on the outside what kind of fish you're dealing with, and this is tilapia, proactive fish, dominant males, and reactive fish. Mind you, another warning for those studying fish and measuring cortisol as a stress hormone, and actually you should measure adrenaline or epinephrine, but also in a population of fish there are these different individuals, and if you lump sum analyze data from these two extremes of the population, you will get an average value with a large standard deviation. Not so if you separate the fish in proactive and reactive. You could do that, there's several tests to do so, but you see the difference in endocrine response. And what you also see is that this fish with adrenaline is at more risk than a reactive fish. This is a risk taker, and it goes with high adrenaline levels, and adrenaline is doing something with the gills. It makes the gills leaky if you don't watch it. So the other message that I want to give, these fish are important for the population as such. The population is strong because there are these extremes and all the intermediates, of course. But what is really important for everybody to understand, that adrenaline is the stress hormone. And we never talk about adrenaline, or almost never, because it's so difficult to determine. Cortisol is relatively easy to determine, but cortisol is an adaptive hormone. Cortisol restores pre-stress conditions. And it is a fundamental difference whether you call it the stress hormone doing something with sugar and providing energy for whatever. It is providing energy for restoration. Yeah. Here an example of differences. You see that a dominant fish has a milder stress response with cortisol than the subordinate fish in this case, and the consequences for a fight experience are eventually pathological if this lasts too long or too often. I did a recent analysis on carp, where the question came, is there laterality in the brain of the fish? And what we did, we fin clipped the fish and split the brain for analysis, and we analyzed the plasma after giving the fish a stress. So we measured cortisol, in this case as a proxy for stress. Stress increases, and this is just handling stress or chasing or whatever. You get a very significant increase in cortisol. If we tail fin clip or right or left pectoral fin clip, you also see there is a significant response of the fish. This is about 10 minutes after the clip. And then we looked in the tail encephalon, and what you can see, let's look at the combined results here. In the tail encephalon, so that is the frontal part of the brain, there is a response. CFOS, early gene marker, goes up, the gene expression, which means that the fish, when you clip it and you induce stress, works with that information in the frontal part of the brain. That is my message. And you've seen indications from Felicity about equivalence for hippocampus, amygdala, prefrontal cortex, and so on and so on. Enrichment. Should we enrich? Yes. Maybe yes, maybe no. What we did, we monitored fish. Here you see the actual setup for qualitative analysis of behavior and quantitative presence of behavior. And we compared the effects of enrichment. We put a Perspex plate and tubing to mimic reed. And what happens? So here you see a comparison between two strains of zebrafish. And that's another message in this study, that the strains are very different. You see the tigmotaxic behavior of the AB strain, that's the wild type, And you see here a TLF, that is a zebrafish strain due to domestication, has two mutations, one leading to longer fins and the other to a leopard pattern in the skin. But their behaviors are very different. And now the question is, of course, what is going on if you put on this enrichment? Well, you see that AB is using the enrichment immediately. And these are 24-hour scores, so heat maps as they are called. The TLF is not responding at all to enrichment. So the Dutch authorities, food and welfare authorities, said, well, maybe we should give to all fish now enrichment. And I said, let's wait. We looked for aggressive behavior, and we've defined it and have a look at it later on. And what we can see is if you give enrichment to a wild-type zebrafish, the animal becomes more aggressive. It starts to fight for its territory that it defines over there. So be careful with your enrichment. Finally, final section, which is still... you have to give me 5 minutes extra. Less lunch. There was a film science in Nijmegen recently. Radboud University organized it. And they showed a film, Artificial. And we won the public prize for this film. There were more than 40 movies shown. And this is on salmon. And I had to frame the film for a layman public and also for the board of the university. So I got a little bit nervous. And I said, well, a little bit of culture around it to make it attractive. This is Akrotiri Santorini in the Aegean Sea, where you can find the wonderful frescoes. He's a fisherman. This is 1500, 2000 before Christ. Abundance of fish in the sea, and you see a reflection of that. No problems. What's going on at the moment? Well, this fisherman from Akrotiri is somewhere here. And here we are for a long time. And then there was the Industrial Revolution, and the world population is increasing like mad. We are at 7 billion, over 7 billion right now, and predictions are that we go over 11 billion. And we eat protein, and we eat fish protein quite a bit. Fisheries are going down, aquaculture is going up for this very reason. Why is that? Among others, because we know that if you put 100 kilograms feed into a fish, you get 61 kilograms back, which is far better than all the other bio-industry subjects. So that's a good reason from an economical point of view. I leave this slide for you to have a look at the numbers, what's going on in aquaculture. The only thing I can say in short, in a nutshell from this slide, it is a big business and it is going on, and it is potentially an important business for food production if you want to feed 7 or 11 billion people on Earth. We are doing so with salmon, and about salmon, everybody knows that salmon is showing this urealinity change. So it's going from freshwater where it spawns and then grows up to par level and then goes from par to smolt in the estuaries and then goes to sea for growing up in its life. Salmon, as such, is a species that is really intertwined with human culture. This is a slide from the Northwest Coast Indians. And this is called dog salmon, or in their language, chum salmon. And the Indians, for instance, believe that they come from the salmon people. So they go back in their history to, say, biblical times, and they say, well, we have a strong link with these fish, and we have to be very careful about them. They are ultimately important for their well-being and living and economy for the Indians. If you look at what's happening in the Californian, it's going to be two. I'm almost there. Salmon in California Central Valley, dams have been built for irrigation purposes, and the decline in fish is phenomenal. And that is because we hamper natural spawning of these fish. So what are people doing? In North America, restocking, in Norway, aquaculture to get more fish. And you see the problems already. Here, temperature is an additional problem in aquaculture settings, because 1 or 2 degrees Celsius for a fish can be a lot, as an ectotherm. And of course, there's these parasite infections, which are phenomenal nowadays. Let's see what happens with restocking in Northern America. Very shortly, natural populations of salmon and several species are seriously affected by well-meant restocking programs. So what people are doing, Culturing fish, so they catch adult fish that come back for spawning, collect eggs and sperm, fertilize, and one female in that case produces 4,500 offspring. And those offspring are grown up and put back in nature. The result is that the natural populations have lost weight on average by about 50%. And that is because we are, in doing so, fouling the genome of the natural population. How stupid can you be? How well-meant it is. That's what I say here. Even consequences for the orcas on the coast, because they cannot catch their 45 prey, but they have to do with half the size of the fish. Finally, two experiments that we did in Norway. If you take these hatchery reared fish to a net pen for grow-up, we see that there is a subpopulation that stays small. And these fish show all signs of what we in human physiology call depression. And we've looked at the brain serotonergic systems. And what we also have done is looking at cortisol responses. And what we see is that these fish have a continuously activated serotonin system. And the serotonin system normally responds to stress conditions, but not anymore in these fishes. At the same time, they have still a cortisol response, but the cortisol response is also not regulated, I'm doing it again, not regulated by brainstem and brain serotonin system. So there's a lot of things going on. These are fish that are maltreated. These, what we are doing with the best meaning for producing protein is not very good for at least some of the fish that we grow. Final slide, second to final. brain plasticity. If we compare hatchery-reared fish and fish from a river nearby the hatchery in North Norway, then we find out that if you look at the regions again in the tail encephalon, so the frontal part that will become our cerebrum eventually, if you want a human interpretation, then we see that the hatchery-reared hatchery rearing influences cognitive processes. So there's all these regions that are involved in learning and memory and fear and so on and so on. Those are activated or at a different activity level in the hatchery fish because we provide them with conditions that are not natural. That's the message from this slide. Then one of the questions, of course, recently, I have to mention it because in the Netherlands there was a trial not only with pulse fishing, but also now with stunning. This is, of course, an unwanted situation, catching fish, throwing them on deck, and let them die while they are on their way to the filleting machine, being cut open live and degutted and so on and so on. There is a new approach, and I think if we can put a man on the moon, or we can build a dam that will take all the water in China, we can also make boats with stunning machines and take proper care of the fish before we kill them. Stun them such that they are not aware of the dreadful things to come and to happen. So this is the summary. And I have to stop now, I see. For you to remember as a sort of a take-home message, vertebrates with a long evolutionary history, you can learn a lot from fish if you study them, if you get money to study them. This is a problem in the Netherlands and in Belgium. Fish are mostly ectotherms. Physiological consequences are enormous. Huge variety in adaptations to a plethora of niches. Consider your fish where you're taking it from, if you're doing experiments. Gills for breathing and ionoregulation, and the sensitivity for hormones, adrenaline in particular, but also cortisol. Fish can be solitary or social fish. Do keep it in mind when you put 2, 3, or 12 fish in the tank. I've shown you zebrafish studies, I think, with the enrichment for fish, determined by the quality of the ICT equipment that we have. Zebrafish need 5 at least. So we have to redo that, and we will redo it, but I think also the studies on 4 are significant so far. And for sure, if you go into biomedical studies and you're using zebrafish, and zebrafish at this moment is the most used vertebrate model in biomedical studies, remember that it's not a swimming mouse or rat. Thank you very much for your attention.